Welcome to Radio Looks Illicit. I'm your host, Steve Matthews. Today is Thursday, February 16th, 2017, and this is episode number 15. The title of this episode is Immigration, Citizenship, and the Bible, Part 9, Book Review, Peter Brimelow's Alien Nation. Before I get started here, I just wanted to say thanks to a few of my readers. I know I've gotten some encouragement from some of you about the podcast, and I just wanted to say I really appreciate that. So to Nick and to Matt, thank you both very much for your kind comments. I really appreciate that. You know, it's you sit here and you talk into a microphone. Sometimes you wonder if anybody listens to what you say. I don't know. Maybe sometimes that's a good thing if nobody listens. Well, hopefully it's a good thing that somebody tunes in. But anyway, again, thanks so much for the encouragement. I really do appreciate that. What I wanted to talk about here today is continuing the series on immigration, my sort of on again, off again immigration series. You know, when I started writing the immigration series, and I guess this goes back to around Labor Day of 2016. You know, it was in part because I was interested in the issue as it related to the presidential election. But of course, that wasn't really the only reason I've been interested in immigration. I have really kind of been fascinated by the subject for years and years and years. And it's pretty hard to find a lot of, I think, cogent commentary on it. I mean, there's an awful lot that's written. You don't have to look very far in the news media to find things written on immigration. Most of it, in my view, is not sound. There have been some attempts by different people, whether they're secular conservatives, whether they're evangelical conservatives, to take a stab at the immigration issue. But I tend to think that usually those fall short as well. If I had to recommend a single book, maybe, that's been written in fairly recent times on the subject of immigration, I think certainly one of the best. And this one is written from a secular conservative standpoint, is Alien Nation by Peter Brimelow. Now, I don't say that because I agree with everything in the book. I have a number of areas where I disagree with Peter Brimelow and what he says. But even though I can't agree with everything, there are some very valuable aspects about this book. And I think reading it, especially if you haven't really had a chance to sit down and study immigration, say you're coming to it and maybe you want something that would kind of be a primer for you on the history of immigration and some of the big issues that are going on regarding immigration, I really don't think there's a better book out there than this. The book was originally published, I believe it was 1995 was when that was first published, and it is, I don't know if it's still in print. I do know that you can still get copies of it, use copies of it on Amazon, for instance, pretty cheap. So the book is definitely available. And what I wanted to do is I kind of wanted to recap a review that I did of Alien Nation a few weeks ago. This was part 9 of my immigration series, and this was something that was published, as I said, it was about a month ago, and I wanted to just talk through a few of the points that I had made at that time and highlight a few things from the review and maybe add a few additional thoughts in as well. There were a number of things that I really did like about this book, as I said. I think one of the aspects about the book, one of the really nice things about it, is actually just really well written. And it's written in a way that's meant to be understood. Peter Brimelow, if you're not familiar with him, he spent most of his early career, I guess he's about 70 or so now, but he spent most of his early career as a financial journalist, and he worked for a lot of major publications. He does have an MBA from Stanford University. He's originally from England. Interestingly enough, he's an immigrant. He's a naturalized U.S. citizen, and he's writing about immigration. And his general stance when it comes to immigration is you would call him an immigration restrictionist. As I said, he's a very bright guy. Has a lot of knowledge about business. he's a free market guy. He believes in basically limited government. So that's another nice thing about his work, is I think we can at least agree to some extent on free markets. I mean, I'm certainly a free market guy, probably more so even than he is. But he does come about it from a capitalist standpoint, not so much as a socialist. He's written for a number of major publications. I know he wrote for Forbes, for instance. He was a senior editor for them. He was also pretty big in the conservative movement. He wrote at one time for National Review. I think he had the position of senior editor, and he wrote a number of articles for National Review back in the 90s. And eventually, there was a split with Brimlow and National Review, and some of it had to do with his views over immigration. Brimlow is pretty enthusiastic about immigration restriction, and I don't think the National Review really wanted to go there at that time. And I don't know if he was canned or if maybe there was a mutual parting of the ways, but I don't think it was long after Alien Nation was published in 1995 that there was a separation between Brimlow and a National Review. So he's someone who has a substantial pedigree in writing in the big time. He's been a major player. As I said, a very bright guy and a very gifted writer. I like his writing because it is very straightforward. I think he's an honest writer. And in fact, he can actually be entertaining and funny. And this is one of the things that might sound a bit odd when you talk about a book on immigration, particularly immigration restriction. You know, you might think it might be some really very dour, boring thing. But Alien Nation is a fast read. I think it's actually probably one of the easier reads that I've had. But I don't say easy in the sense that it's a bad book. It's not. It's actually quite well written. Brimlow's a really good scholar, in addition to just being able to write in a lucid fashion. He's a gifted scholar, and it's a very well documented book. And so you can find a lot of helpful articles and books and things like that that are in the bibliography, or I should say in the end notes on the book as well. So there's a lot of strong writing in this book. One of the other things that I think is really important about the book is it really serves as an excellent primer on the subject of immigration, and it's written from a completely different standpoint than probably what you're used to. I mean, if you read and you learn about immigration, say, from the mainstream media, you're going to basically get a lot of immigration cheerleading. Basically, what the mainstream media says is the current system that we have is just awesome, and the only thing that would make it awesomer is if we had even more of it. And anybody who raises any questions and says, well, you know, there are some problems with what we have going on here. There's some problems with immigration welfare. There's abuse of the system and things of this sort. If you happen to bring any concerns up, well, you're denounced. You know, you're deplorable. You're a terrible person. You know, you're a bigot. You're awful. You're a xenophobe. This sort of thing. Well, you know, that's not really very helpful. But there are some very powerful vested interests that have an interest in keeping the current system of immigration and refugees going the way that they are. And so just knowing some history about immigration can be very, very helpful, kind of give you a little bit of a framework on how to think about and to talk about some of the current immigration controversies. Just starting off in Alien Nation, early on, and this is just in sort of the first few pages, there's actually a very nice history of immigration going back to the first Immigration Restriction Act in the history of the United States in 1790. That was the Alien and Sedition Act in 1790. Or excuse me, actually it goes back to 1607. Brimlow starts in 1607 with the first permanent English settlement at Jamestown, Virginia. And he proceeds from there. One of the important stopping points in immigration history, not a lot of people realize this, and I don't think that I realized it until I read this book. And I first read Alien Nation many, many years ago. I, you know, probably in the late 90s. It's probably been close to 20 years. I read the book not too terribly long after it had come out. But you know, we often hear about Ellis Island, for instance. You hear lots of praise about Ellis Island. You know, the great wave of immigration took place in from about 1890 to about 1920, and a lot of these immigrants, they were people came from Southern and Eastern Europe, and that this was sort of the whole Ellis Island generation of immigrants. Well, that all came to an end, and it didn't come to an end strictly necessarily naturally. It was actually ended by legislation. There were two major acts of Congress. There was a Quota Act of 1921 and an Immigration Act of 1924 that substantially ended immigration. There was a long period of time, a number of decades, where there simply wasn't very much immigration at all into the United States. And not a lot of people realized that that was done via legislation. And there was, after World War II, there's increasing immigration that took place. But in 1965, and this is really the focus of Brimla's book, there was the Immigration and Nationality Act, sometimes just known as the 1965 Immigration Act, that substantially gave us the immigration policy that we have today. I want to read just a little quote here, and this is from Brimlow's from book from Alien Nation. This is on page 74. This is the start of chapter 4. Quote: "How did it happen? Even now, many Americans still simply do not realize what is causing this ethnic revolution that is transforming their country. They tend to assume that some kind of natural phenomenon is at work, that Hispanics, for example, went from 2.6% of the U.S. population in 1950 to 9% in 1990 because they somehow started sprouting up out of the earth like spring corn." End quote. What you find out from Brimlow, and what he goes on to build his case for this, is that the massive amount of sometimes what he calls non-traditional immigration into the United States over the past roughly 50 years has been the result of policy. You know, there has been a deliberate decision made in Washington by the 1965 Immigration Act that essentially really opened the door to third world immigration into the United States. So, I mean, what we have right now in terms of an immigration policy is a policy. It's not an accident. You know, all of these people coming here from around the world aren't coming here by accident. They are, to a large extent, coming here because of the results of the 1965 Immigration Act. I'll go on and I'll continue to quote a little bit more from Brimlow here. He says that no natural phenomenon is at work. The point cannot be emphasized too strongly. The current wave of immigration, and therefore America's shifting ethnic balance, is wholly and entirely the result of government policy. Specifically, it is the result of the Immigration Act of 1965 and the further legislation of 1986 and 1990. The three fundamental questions of immigration policy are how many get admitted, who, and how is this enforced. All are uniquely within the power of American government officials, even if they prefer to let these questions be decided, as often at present, by default. Put it this way, American immigration policy may be made by commission, or it may be made by omission, but is still made in America, by American politicians. In other words, it's their fault. The politicians, that is. This is one of the things I thought was really interesting in this past presidential election cycle. When you studied through the contrast between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump in terms of their approach to immigration, if you looked at Hillary Clinton's website, at the top it had a picture of her hugging it looked like maybe about a 10-year-old, I would say, Hispanic girl, and in the background there was a sort of a backdrop, and it said "Estoy contigo" in Spanish, which means I am I'm with you in Spanish. It's interesting. During the 2016 election, the Hillary's motto, at least among American voters, English speakers, was "I'm with her." You know, the emphasis was on the "we, the public," were with Hillary, the candidate. But when it came to immigration, the immigrants weren't with Hillary. Hillary was with the immigrants. She made a very strong identification with, in particular, the Hispanic immigrants. On the other hand, if you looked at Donald Trump's website and you looked at his section under immigration, he made what I thought was a pretty important point, and that is he said that immigration policy — this isn't an exact quote, it's a paraphrase here — but he said that immigration policy ought to be designed to benefit all Americans. Now, you know, you might think that that's doesn't need to be said, but apparently it does, because very often, and this was certainly the case with Hillary, it seems as though her immigration policy was designed not with what was best for Americans in mind, but what was best for immigrants, or at least potential immigrants, or migrants, or refugees. She didn't even make any attempt in her statements on immigration to appeal to Americans and what their best interests would be. Now, you know, of course, ultimately, what are proper self-interests? You know, what is truly the best long-term interest of the American people? That has to be settled as Christians. Of course, we have to settle that from the Bible, from Scripture. Hillary didn't even attempt to appeal to the best interests of Americans, or even to appeal to Americans just as voters. She was working solely to pander to certain immigrant special interests, whereas Donald Trump actually did attempt to appeal to the best interest of the American people. And I thought that was a pretty important contrast. You know, back to the main point that Trump made, Brimlow made in his book, it's important to understand that our current immigration policy is, in fact, policy. You don't have the things going on with immigration. You don't have all this massive issue with illegal immigration, with taxpayer-supported welfare immigrants and refugees and things of this sort. You don't have all of this going on by accident. You know, these people aren't springing up out of the ground. They're coming here because of, at least in some cases, perverse incentives that have been created by U.S. policymakers, either through the 1965 Immigration Act or also in connection with other acts, things such as welfare, the welfare state, birthright citizenship. All of these things tend to work together to create a very powerful magnet for people to come to this country, even come here illegally, because we reward illegal behavior. I think it was Ronald Reagan who made the point. He says, if you subsidize something, you get more of it. Well, American immigration policy is custom designed to subsidize massive welfare immigration. So we shouldn't be surprised when we get massive amounts of welfare-seeking immigrants. Not all immigrants are that way, of course, and I don't mean to suggest that. There are a lot of immigrants that come here and do not necessarily go on welfare and actually do produce positive benefits for our country. There's no question about that. People come here, and they come here to work hard, and I don't mean by any means to suggest that that's not the case. But when you have a system set up that's designed to reward people, especially people who come to the country contrary to our immigration laws, you know, that's a problem. And when those immigration laws themselves tend to favor, you know, as Brimlow talks about, massive changes in the ethnic balance in the United States, you know, it's fair to ask, you know, is this sound policy? Now, maybe we get into looking at immigration, maybe you find out, well, you know, maybe the 1965 Immigration Act's a great thing. Maybe you get to looking at it and you say, well, maybe it's not such a great thing. In my opinion, I think that there are some serious problems with the 1965 Immigration Act. But again, the big point, the big takeaway from Peter Brimlow is the fact that this is policy. It's not an accident. It's not an unstoppable force of nature. It is government policy that we have the current immigration system we have. And that is, if you get nothing else out of this book, I really think that that's the main thing that you want to take. Now, there are a few other things in Alien Nation that are certainly worth talking about. Brimlow doesn't talk a lot about this, but he does talk about the 1980 Refugee Act. You probably weren't aware of this, but there was a major piece of legislation in 1980 that created a lot of the framework for the current refugee policy. Now, again, Brimlow was writing this in the mid-1990s, and so you didn't really have the focus on refugees the way that you do right now. It's important to keep in mind there's a distinction between immigrants and refugees. An immigrant is somebody who comes to a country, not his own, with the purpose of being a permanent resident or becoming a citizen. In other words, it's a long-term commitment. On the other hand, when we talk about refugees, we're talking about people who the focus is more short-term. Maybe there's a war going on in somebody's home country, or maybe there's persecution because you've got some crazy, horrible ruler. Well, maybe somebody has to flee for his life, and they come to the United States. Well, the idea would be that when the emergency situation is over, that person would go back home. That's the thought, anyway, behind being a refugee. So there's a distinction between immigrants and refugees. They're similar classes of people, but there's a distinction there, and it's important to keep that in mind. One of the things that Brimlow talks about in his book about the 1980 Refugee Act, he says it was the first explicit recognition of refugees as a permanent, distinct immigration stream. Elsewhere, toward the end of the book, he says this. He says, the United States did not acquire a comprehensive refugee policy until the Refugee Act of 1980. And he also says that it was promptly captured and debauched by special interest groups. And that's also true. I've written a little bit about that in a post I call The Refugee Racket. And I won't get into that too much here at this point, but just to mention it briefly, the refugee system that we have in this country is a massive taxpayer-funded, it's a racket. And it's something that desperately needs to be changed. It desperately needs to be reformed. It does not work in the interests of the people of the United States. People often talk about welfare for immigrants, but what they don't understand is that refugees are far more lavishly cared for by the welfare system than our immigrants. If somebody comes to the United States, say, illegally as an immigrant, that person cannot apply for welfare. Now, if, say, someone comes to the United States as an illegal immigrant and has a child, has an anchor baby, in the United States, the family, the mother, the father, they can apply for welfare on behalf of the child because the child is a U.S. citizen. But even that, it's somewhat limited. However, when a refugee comes to the United States, refugees are eligible for the entire panoply of the gigantic American welfare state. And I don't think a lot of people realize that. So there's a distinction between the way the welfare system treats refugees and the way the welfare system treats certainly illegal immigrants into the United States. Another aspect of the alienation that I think is pretty interesting is Brimlow's discussion about the so-called nativists. Maybe if you've done much reading on immigration, or even just a little bit of reading on immigration, it doesn't take too long to come across the swear word nativist. If somebody maybe even expresses a mild concern about the current immigration system and the way things are being done, he's immediately tagged with being a nativist. And of course, calling somebody a nativist is a swear word, and it's not really meant to promote thought. It's really meant to end a discussion. Calling somebody a nativist is not too terribly far from calling somebody a racist. You see that phenomenon in various fields. For instance, like if somebody starts talking about foreign policy and someone brings up the fact that, oh, you know, well, maybe we shouldn't be getting involved in all these foreign wars, immediately that person will be set upon, and somebody will say, why, you isolationist, and when you call somebody an isolationist, you're saying that person is deplorable. That person is beyond the pale. That person should never be listened to. And it's the same kind of thing when we talk about immigration. Anybody who maybe expresses any concerns over the current immigration system is immediately called a nativist, and essentially more or less written out of the discussion. You're beyond the pale. You're deplorable. We can't talk to you. Polite people, good people, right-thinking people don't support nativists. Well, Brimlow talks a little bit about nativism. If you know a little bit about American history, you might know that in the 1840s and 1850s, there was a massive Roman Catholic immigration into the United States from Ireland and also to some extent from Germany. And this caused a lot of consternation in the United States, which was, and even still is, even to this day, is still a majority Protestant nation. But you really saw an explosion in Roman Catholicism via immigration in the 1840s and 1850s, and people became concerned about this. And in one of the groups, probably the best-known group to come out of that particular time, was a group called the Know-Nothings. And it's interesting whenever you hear the Know-Nothings mentioned in the popular press, it's always negative. To call somebody a nativist, to call somebody a know-nothing, I mean, they're pretty much the same thing. And any time you read an article that is in support of immigration, almost always the know-nothings are trotted out, and it's always basically said of them, well, look at these people back, 150 years ago. They were obviously wrong in worrying about all of the Roman Catholic immigration. And in the same way, people today who complain about Muslims or Muslim immigration or Muslim refugees, well, they're in the same boat. Just as the know-nothings were wrong 150 years ago, so people today are wrong, who are concerned about Muslim immigration. And it's just assumed, without any sort of a proof, that the know-nothings were just a bunch of ignoramuses. They're a bunch of bigots, and again, just all around deplorable people. Well, when you look a little bit at the history of that particular era, it seems to me that it may be possible. Maybe the Know-Nothings had a point. Maybe the Know-Nothings actually had some legitimate concerns. But if you read modern history, you will never see that expressed. In fact, really, the Know-Nothings are, I think, really one of historians' favorite whipping boys. It's easy to beat up on them, and it's easy to pile on and talk about what horrible people they were. But if you look at the history, I don't think that they were horrible people. And in my opinion, I think that they had some very valid concerns. I'm not defending everything that they said or everything that they believed. The Know-Nothings, for instance, are largely responsible for the public education system. It's kind of interesting because this is a group of people who wanted to, were Protestants, and they wanted to protect the Protestant heritage of the United States against the massive Roman Catholic immigration. One of the things they turned to was state-sponsored schooling. And of course we know how that turned out. Public education has become its own established American church. And it's a church that teaches a catechism of unbelief, of secularism, of humanism, of Darwinism. And the public schools owe their start to a lot of these evangelicals attempting to use the state to combat Rome. So, I mean, the Know-Nothings certainly made their mistakes. But I don't think they were all wrong either. And I think they deserve credit for areas where maybe they were right. And actually, Brimlow is the only author that I've seen, and I say this in all seriousness, I have not seen another author actually have anything good to say about the Know-Nothings. He's the first one that I've come across anyway, at least in recent times. I'll read a few comments that read a little bit of what he says about the Know-Nothings. This is on page page 12 of Alien Nation. The nativists were genuine American originals, members of the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner, a secret patriotic society about which its members were instructed to deny knowledge, supposedly the origin of their famous nickname, the Know-Nothings. Organizing themselves as the American Party in the mid-1850s, they scored stunning but short-lived successes on the eve of the Civil War. But the Know-Nothings were far from an ignorant mob, as immigration enthusiasts, probably misunderstanding that nickname, tend to assume. Recent research has shown that they were a cross-section of solid middle and upper class, solid middle and upper middle class citizens, and the Know-Nothings never actually proposed restricting immigration. That's pretty interesting. They never proposed restricting immigration. Just that, in the words of the Know-Nothing governor of Massachusetts, Henry J. Gardner, Americans should take care to nationalize before we naturalize any new immigrants. Nor were the Know-Nothings anti-Semitic. The Know-Nothings were, however, deeply suspicious of Roman Catholicism, at a time when enormous Irish Catholic immigration had begun after the potato famine of 1845. Anti-Catholicism is not a sentiment you often find in America today, although you can get a whiff of it talking to abortion rights and gay rights activists. And it needs to be set in the context of the time. No doubt bigotry played a part, but so did a quite rational concern that Roman Catholicism, with its hierarchical structure, and this is the money quote, but so did a quite rational concern that Roman Catholicism, with its hierarchical structure, unlike Judaism with its self-governing congregations, was not a republican religion, one which would be compatible with democracy, free institutions, law, and liberty. After all, Pope Pius IX was now fervently denouncing liberalism, by which he meant all free thought and free institutions, and supporting the despotisms that had crushed liberal revolutions all across Europe in 1848. Indeed, in 1853, enraged native-born Americans and immigrant exiles of 48 united to riot against the visit of Papal Nuncio Gaetano Bedini, called the Butcher of Bologna, because of his role in suppressing the revolt against papal rule there. Above all, the Know-Nothings were against slavery. So, we have a very different picture of what the Know-Nothings from what you're probably used to. The Know-Nothings didn't propose restricting immigration. They proposed that people who came to the United States should become nationalized before they became naturalized. In other words, they wanted to ensure that they actually had absorbed American ideas about limited government, private property, personal freedom, these sorts of things. The kinds of things that that I certainly cherish as a Christian and certainly are supported by our Constitution as well. The Know-Nothings had some good reasons to be concerned about Roman Catholicism. In fact, it's kind of interesting that Brimla brings up this Gaetano Bedini, the Butcher of Bologna. I did a little bit of research on this. I found out he actually showed up here in Cincinnati. I live in the Cincinnati area, and they had a great big riot in Cincinnati in 1853 when this guy came to Cincinnati. Cincinnati actually found out has a very long history of rioting. We've been pretty darn good at it for about the last 225 years, and this was one of the bigger ones that we've had here in River City. Although Brimlow doesn't specifically talk about the Cincinnati riot, he just refers more to the general outrage that was felt among American citizens at that time. There's a little bit about the Know-Nothings, and Lord willing, I hope to be able to write. I'd like to be able to write an installment of Immigration, Citizenship, and the Bible, talking specifically about the Know-Nothings, because it's a pretty interesting group, and I think we can learn from them, both from some of the legitimate concerns that they did have, also as well as from some of the mistakes that they made. And I already mentioned one, the fact that they wanted to rely on the state via public education for dealing with the major influx of Roman Catholicism. Ultimately, as I said, I can't agree with Brimlow's full analysis. Basically, what he does is he the overarching argument of his book is runs something like this. I don't believe I'm being unfair to him when I say this, but he talks several times in the book about America in 1950 or maybe 1960, and the fact that it was 90% European, it was 90% white, it was 10% black, and there were very little. In the way of other ethnic groups. It was basically a biracial society, in other words, is what Brimlow says. And he talks in the book about the fact that, well, Americans ought to demand or have a right to demand that the government shift the ethnic balance back. That's been changed by the 1965 Immigration Act. Well, you can't simply say because the United States was 90% white in 1960, that it ought to be 90% white today. That's leaping across what's sometimes known as Hume's gap. It's one thing to talk in terms of, you know, what are called descriptive statements. Descriptive statements purport to talk about what is. It's one thing to talk, you know, you have prescriptive statements and say, well, the ethnic balance in the United States was such and such in 1960. But you can't say because the ethnic balance was such and such in 1960 that therefore it ought to be the same today. I don't know what the ethnic balance of the United States ought to be. And I don't think ultimately anybody else really does either. You know, I don't know what that should be. What I think we have to have is we need to have an immigration policy that is just. We need to have an immigration policy that is fair. And I haven't fully written all of this out, but I have talked about it briefly in a few places. One of the things we need to do to ensure we have fair immigration policy, we need to get rid of the welfare state. Not just for immigrants, but we need to get rid of the welfare state, period. I mean, I object to welfareism, regardless of who's getting the money. Although I will have to say, when the welfare is flowing to people who are not citizens, that's an aggravating circumstance. Another thing we need to do is we need to get rid of the anchor baby issue. There's no good reason why a mother should come to the United States and have a child within the territory of the United States and then have that child rewarded with citizenship. That's incredible debasement of citizenship. There's no sound philosophical reason for it. There's no sound Christian, biblical reason for that. There's no sound, I think, ultimately constitutional reason for that. That's something that needs to change. Another issue that needs to be grappled with, and it gets down to affirmative action. When you have large numbers of minorities immigrate to the United States, all of those people become eligible, they become part of the protected class. And this is, you know, so not only you're importing a welfare constituency, you're also importing an affirmative action constituency. So that's something that needs to be dealt with. That's actually an incentive, and a lot of people don't realize that, but when minorities immigrate to the United States, they are covered by affirmative action. So that's another issue that needs to be addressed when we're talking about immigration, because it does has an effect on the people, the American people who are already here. And that's something that really does need to be considered as part of, you know, they use the term comprehensive immigration reform, but I don't think that anybody ever really brings up the affirmative action part of it. But that really does need to be part of any sort of long-term reform of immigration, in my opinion. Brimlow does talk about that some in his book as well. But anyway, to kind of wrap things up, I think I'm kind of rambling here a little bit. I think Brimlow's book is a really good primer. I would highly recommend it to you. I don't agree with everything in there, but it is a good source to begin studying the immigration issue by a gifted author and by somebody who actually can write in a clear and concise way. With that, I want to wrap things up here. And As I go, I did want to leave you with this thought, and that is, may the Spirit of truth guide you in all truth as you read and study God's Word. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to talking next time. Goodbye.